The case of Michael and Kathleen Peterson has captivated the public for years, prompting intense debate and speculation. In 2003, Kathleen Peterson was found dead at the bottom of a staircase in her home, leading to a trial that would become one of the longest in North Carolina's history. Michael Peterson, her husband, was ultimately convicted of the first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without parole. The tragedy took a series of shocking turns as theories and evidence emerged, painting a complex picture of the events leading to Kathleen's death. The infamous owl theory, which suggests that Kathleen may have been attacked by an owl, added a layer of mystery to the case, sparking widespread discussion and skepticism. Despite the guilty verdict, the case continued to unfold, with Michael Peterson being granted a new trial in 2011 due to misleading testimony. This development reignited public interest in the case and raised profound questions about the judicial process and the true circumstances surrounding Kathleen's untimely death. The compelling saga of the Petersons and the contentious legal proceedings have left many fascinated by the enigmatic details and lingering uncertainties. As a complex and tragic story continues to capture attention, it serves as a poignant reminder of the enduring impact of unresolved mysteries and the quest for truth and justice. All right, we're live.
Yeah.
Lena's like, I don't know what to do. We are live.
Mm-hmm.
This is, okay, so this is our guilty or not guilty, okay?
Pleasure.
Mini series, which is actually not really mini.
Right.
It was supposed to be mini, but it's not. So we're going to go ahead and introduce. We've got our drinks back. We've got all three of us. We're actually in the same room. Super excited. Right. Super excited. So hit us off, sister.
Yeah, we're back. Better than before. Isn't that a song, too? I'm on a roll, man.
What's with all the songs?
Or is it a cheer? It's one of those. I'll get back to you. Hi, I'm Elena.
I'm Mom.
And I am Sherry, and this is Outline of a Murder podcast. And I actually forgot.
What is she doing?
I forgot a mom saying.
Oh, I'm so happy. I was just thinking, hoping you did.
Oh, stand by.
I forgot all, like any mom saying.
You've done that for years. You've got to think of something. Nothing bad.
We'll get back to you.
Yes, yes. We'll have two next time.
Okay. Well, no. How about just one?
No, two.
Done. Because
okay.
Y'all,
okay. Cheers. So,
y'all messed up. Boy, she's ready to drink.
Okay, so we have Poppy.
Poppy.
Poppy. It is a prebiotic soda, so it's good for the belly.
I've heard of that.
Is it going to give me toots?
Well, that's up to you and your digestive tract. I have no idea. I'm not a doctor. I can't diagnose.
I think that happens to her a lot, though. I have heard about this.
Not bad at all.
It's orange.
It was on the TV last night.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. So where do you buy it in case people want to get some?
Grocery stores. What else do you need to know?
Well,
I see why people end up welcome in prison to my world. Killing people.
I mean, there is Google. No, I ordered this one. Walmart.
Oh, so it is Walmart? Mm-hmm. Oh, when you said ordered, I thought maybe you got it in special for the podcast. So you just went to Walmart, literally? That's what you did?
No, I ordered it online.
She didn't go to the store.
Walmart, and I had a delivery. Do you want details? Would you like date stamps?
No, I just expected maybe a little bit more, you know.
Hey, unusualness. You do it all the time. No, so my hairdresser, Crystal, at Candace Maud in Fort Worth, fabulous. She was telling me about this drink that she started doing in the evening, and it's called, I'll get back to you on that, but she mixes the orange poppy with moon juice magnesium. It's their berry one. Okay. And then she tops it off with, I think maybe Topo Chico. And she said it's better than wine at night. She sleeps
really
so good. I know.
Well, and alcohol actually makes you sleep worse.
I know.
Yeah.
It jacks with your
hormones. I'm going to have to get that recipe. So everybody that's listening, write it down. And it sounds delicious. I've never heard of moon milk, though.
I haven't either. I don't even know what it is.
I don't know moon what juice. Moon milk is.
Moon juice.
Whatever. I'm thinking white milk, moon milk.
Me too.
Makes sense.
Moonshine.
With it's milk. Moonshine.
With yeah. milk.
She even puts it in a wine glass. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. No. Okay. So orange poppy. She puts half in a wine glass. The moon juice, which is a scoop of magnesium.
Okay.
She stirs it up and then tops it off with cherry tart juice.
Okay.
Oh, I think the moon juice is another flavor of this, isn't it? Of the.
It's magnesium.
Oh. Okay.
You're
set that.
Tangled in your. Okay. All right. The theme. Okay.
Thank you.
The theme of this mid-season miniseries is guilty or not guilty. I wanted to go over some of the cases where there's a lot of controversy over the guilt or innocence of the accused. We're going to start off with this one, which is the Michael Peterson case.
Who? Michael Peterson?
Yes. What was
I'm
that?
I'm so excited. I really like this one.
Well, yeah. Are we going to say if we believe the person or
no,
is
we're just
going to
discuss it and then not give our opinions.
No, I mean at the first, are we going to say what we think or at the end?
I like that idea. Let's do both.
Okay.
Okay, that's a really good idea.
To see if it changes.
Right there, you know what I'm saying? Shoot.
That was sort of weak, Elena.
Okay. I'll see why.
So as far, let's do that. But before we do on this case, we're going to look at Scott Peterson. We're going to look at Darlie Routier, and some that they maybe have never heard of, the Hendricks family murders. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at James Daly and then Kyron Horman. And I just want to warn everybody that will probably be very controversial, what I believe happened there, that a lot of people, they might get mad, but I don't really care if they get mad or not. But it's going to be some good ones. And I put them in order of the ones I'm pretty like 100% sure what I think, all the way down to one I cannot decide. And so I'm super excited to hear you guys. But Mama, since it was your idea, what do you think about Michael Peterson? Do you think he was guilty?
Yes.
Okay. Elena?
Not sure.
I'm a no. I don't think he was guilty.
Oh, you don't?
Mm-mm. Nope. Now, I do want to warn, if I do put the photos and the things up, that there are some crime scene photos. I have them divided up to where I'll warn you before I open those. But it's going to be very important that we look at the wounds on her scalp.
Okay? Oh, okay.
So let's go ahead and dive into this. Now, I wrote this a while back, so hopefully, you know, I can follow my notes along and nothing sounds weird. I've wanted to discuss this for years because of the intriguing owl situation.
Owl?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's an owl involved.
You're thinking of another one.
I think I am.
Probably.
Yeah.
I think maybe we shouldn't have you give your opinion because if you don't know who the hell we're talking
you'll
about.
I'll remember and then I'll blurt it out.
How about I just show you a picture a couple?
The dude. Maybe a better one.
Glasses, please. Oh, yeah. Guilty as hell.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
Yes. All I know exactly who he is. Okay. I saw him interviewed after. He's such a jerk.
Well, being a jerk doesn't necessarily mean you're guilty of murder.
Well, it does for him.
Okay. All right. Well, on that note, so I'm sure our listeners have heard of this case. It's a very famous case. They just did the HBO series called The Staircase, which quite frankly was actually very hard to watch. Did you watch it?
A couple years ago.
I watched it.
You remember the death scenes, right? Like they were disturbing. I had nightmares.
Oh, you did?
I think it's a newer one. It just came out.
It just came out.
On HBO.
Oh. Well,
They've had a few.
Yeah, I watched a documentary. It was called The Staircase a couple of years ago.
This wasn't a documentary. This was like they had the actors.
Oh, and
they
this was a documentary.
Yeah, you don't want to watch it.
What is... Okay. Do you want to know why I think he's guilty? Or wait till the end?
I would just like to be able to finish my okay. sentence. So, we have the Michael Peterson case. It's gained more attention because of The Staircase on HBO. I just want to tell the listeners that if you watch that, the death scenes are very, very disturbing and they can get to you. Did you watch it, Mom?
I did.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So,
and you were fine. You slept like a baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did.
Slept like a baby.
No, it was disturbing. Okay, so why do you think he's guilty?
Because of those scenes, the way the head was at the end of the stairs and how they matched the wounds. And the only thing is some of the wounds didn't really match. Well,
they
where she could have hit her head as she was going down. It was interesting. Mm-hmm. But I'd always thought he was guilty, but mm-hmm. I don't know.
Okay. So our case begins in Durham, North Carolina. It's a city of about 284,000 residents. I thought it was bigger, so I was kind of surprised. It is the fourth largest city in North Carolina, and it's a very conservative town. And that does play a part, I believe, mm-hmm. in what happened with the case. It's also home of Duke University, North Carolina Central University. It's a national leader in health-related activities, which I didn't know, but they have the Duke University Hospital there. So kind of like Georgetown, the Georgetown Hospital where the kiddos live. It's, you know, a happening place, I guess you would say. It
if
also
you were 90.
Has, do what?
If you were 90.
Be a happening place.
Georgetown?
The hospital.
No, oh, just that yeah. phrase.
And then it has what's called a research triangle. So you've got the University of North Carolina, and then you've got the other two. And so they have a lot of, you know, just different things that they do that benefit America, that benefit health and education, et cetera. Now, Kathleen, I'll get this picture. It's one of my favorites of her. She Aww. Was born and raised in Greensboro. And that's the third most popular city, and they have almost 300,000 residents. She was a first woman admitted to Duke University School of Engineering.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah.
That's impressive.
And she worked at a pharmaceutical company after college, and then she joined the Nortel telecommunications giant at the height of the tech bubble. Do y'all remember Nortel?
Yeah.
I mm-hmm. do, too. And then all of a sudden, it's like they're gone.
Right.
So I don't know what happened after. She was the VP of Nortel when she died. And she had stock before the tech bubble busted worth over $2 million. Post-tech bubble, it was only worth $50,000. Yeah,
oh.
So the stock plummeted. And she earned, though, she was still doing well. She earned $154,000 a year, which is not bad back, you know. I may not have even put the date. My goodness. Yeah, I didn't put the date. So that would be early 2000s, I believe, when the tech bubble bust. So, and then you have Michael Peterson. He was actually a Tennessee native. He also graduated from Duke with a bachelor's in political science. He was the president of Duke's fraternity, Sigma Nu, and the editor of the Chronicle. And then he also took some law classes at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And you could tell, I mean, both of them very intelligent, very accomplished people. And there's not a single photo of them where I could see any body language or facial expression like of contempt or anything. I mean, they looked genuinely happy.
They look real happy there.
So, you know, the first one is their wedding, and I love how she's touching mm-hmm. his shoulder. Like, it seems like a natural thing, not like a photo.
He seems very natural as well.
Oh, yeah. He's weird looking, though, like his eyebrows.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened.
Yeah, we need to clean those up, sir.
And then, of course, him. And you've got the you know, turkey going on right there. And then this is another one of them. And then they had a rather large family because of different circumstances. So this is all of them with, it looks like just one of the sons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then these two daughters, I believe, on this side are actually from their friends that died in Germany. And so we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But they, you know, he took custody of them. So there they are, the entire family. And it doesn't look like that photo is much before, you know, she died.
Right.
And then you have their house. Their house was huge. We'll get to that in a second. But they just seemed like a very close-knit family. They did have, you know, like some family problems. One of the sons got into some legal trouble, which I think we go over in the show notes. But in 1965, Peterson married a lady named Sue, and they had two children, which are Clayton and Todd. So that's the boys. Clayton was living with Kathleen and Michael at the time of her death, and he was a troubled young man. He tried to bomb the main admin building at Duke where he was a freshman.
Wow.
Yeah, at the Pratt School of Engineering there. So he served 4 years in prison.
Why does it say why he did it or was trying to do that? Hmm. Bad grade, just angry. Just,
I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah, I have no idea. When I'm shaking my head, Mom, question. That means I don't know.
That's okay. Ask your questions.
Well, she did. I'm like, no. And she's like, for anger or anything? Well, no.
I don't know. Memory.
I'm just giving you a rough time.
I'm used to it. That's okay.
Yes, you do get a lot of flack. So I'm thinking, wow. I'm thinking that he was probably freshly out of prison for him to still be at the house. Mm-hmm. And then in 1968, Michael volunteered for the Marines.
Yes. Oh.
Served in Vietnam. He was honorably discharged after 4 years when a car accident left him disabled. He and Patricia lived in Germany for many years, and Patricia was an elementary school teacher at an American military base. And I guess, from what I could find, he did not work during that time, but he started working on his novels, because he was a novelist. Mm-hmm. And they became very close friends with a George and Elizabeth Ratliff. So you'll hear of Elizabeth a lot. I'm sure you guys remember her in the case. And then their two children, Margaret and Martha. And this relationship is going to come back to haunt him later on. But for the moment, both George, who was a military man, he died in Grenada eventually. And then Elizabeth also died, leaving Margaret and Martha orphans. So Michael raised the girls like they were his own daughters. And it makes you wonder, like, were they not grandparents, you know, or were they too old to take care of the granddaughter? Like, to me, it had to have been a close relationship for someone to entrust your daughters.
Oh, yeah.
Like your children to you.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only two people that I could think of that I would have been comfortable raising Kent.
Not only that, but whenever you're asked that, that's a huge responsibility. Mm-hmm. That takes a lot of thought.
It does.
Yeah. And I know of people that have declined.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a big decision.
Did he adopt them or just...
That's a good question.
Probably legal reasons he would have had to, I bet.
I'm thinking so. Mm-hmm. And their last name, it is Peterson, you know. So
I bet.
Order to get that, huh, you have to adopt. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's them, the two on the right
here?
Yeah.
And by the way, in the HBO Staircase, the people that played them, like, they look like them. Like, it's disturbing. It was hard to match Michael Peterson's face because he's so weird looking. But like Kathleen, her character, but the girl that played her, wow, she could have been her doppelganger, the one with the glasses.
Yeah.
And then the one at the front over on this side in the pink shirt, that is Kathleen and Michael's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, it may be Kathleen's daughter. I think I get into it.
I think it's her daughter.
Yeah, because she had her from a previous marriage.
I think so.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. So they're basically they epitomize a blended family. Mm-hmm. That's for sure. But they seem to get along really, really well.
They'll look happy there.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can kind of tell, too, that they seem to have like a good sense of humor, mm-hmm. like in a lot of the photographs. Eventually, Peter, I guess I needed to put my phone on silent. Wow. Okay. Here we go. Let me just go ahead and put this on Do Not Disturb. Mom's the only one that got that. So Patricia and Michael, they divorced. And from what I can tell, Patricia continued living in Germany with the boys for a while. And then Michael returned to Durham with the girls.
Oh.
And that's that strange. Was in 1986. Yeah. And then eventually the boys did move to Durham to be with their dad. And Patricia ended up back in the States as well. And her and Michael seemed to get along. I mean, they had several phone conversations. They would discuss the boys. When they needed monetary help, they would discuss it. And she even was by his side the entire time he was on trial. She like basically moved in and took care of all of them while they focused on his defense.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. And then while Michael and Patricia were estranged, and in the same year he moved back to the States, he met Kathleen. And she was married at the time. They moved in together in 1989, and they dated for 10 years while waiting for their divorces to make their way through the courts.
What? 10 years?
10 years. I'm like, why would a divorce take 10 years? So
had to be fighting or something, right?
I don't know. I mean, maybe on her side. And if Patricia's still in Germany, maybe that made things.
And then the kids,
but
maybe?
10 years? So, wow. Yeah, they dated for 10 years. And they married in 1997 after they were finalized. And then Kathleen's daughter, the one in the pink, she moved in. Her name is Caitlin. She moved in with the now very blended family. So Kathleen, she was an executive, but also a socialite. So she loved parties and visiting and the arts. And so in their house, you know, which is gorgeous, she would often host gala receptions, you know, for local dance groups and art groups. And the home itself was worth $1.8 million. So it's a nice home, but it looks like it's an older home. Mm-hmm. So there's like different, like, you know, in older homes, there's like, they're not as open. And there's lots of little cubby holes and rooms and things like that. So
is that reporters or is that one of their get-togethers?
That's reporters. Wow. Yeah.
Three fireplaces.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It looks gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like all the windows.
And this, like, she would do all of this after a full day at the office. No. You know, and being a VP, being an exec, that is not easy.
It's not 8 to 5, for sure.
Yeah. And, I mean, and her job was becoming increasingly demanding at the time as well because of the tech bubble bursting. So that is, you know, their stocks have plummeted. I mean, if you go from $2 million to $50,000, you can imagine the hit that this company took. She's a VP, so it's very, very stressful. But Michael said that she was immensely funny, intelligent, warm, and just so quick. And then her neighbor, Maureen Berry, called her a 48-hour-per-day woman because she lived her life to the fullest and she only slept 4 to 5 hours a night. So she was a ball of energy. 4 to 5 hours? Yeah, no. No, I wouldn't be able to do it.
How old was she at that time?
Of her death, do you know? I mean, I'm thinking, what, early 40s or late 30s? Early 40s, maybe 50?
I'm thinking 40s at least.
At least, maybe. If any of our listeners know, just let us know, because that's something I didn't look up either. All righty.
All good questions.
Thanks, Mom, for asking all these questions I don't know the answers to. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So he started his novel writing. He had The Immortal Dragon, A Time of War, and A Bitter Peace. And then he also wrote a biography, Charlie Two Shoes, and the Marines of Love Company. He definitely seemed to be successful with his books. He was also controversial. He was an editorial columnist for the Durham Herald newspaper, and he regularly criticized law enforcement and the racial divide.
Well, that probably didn't help him, criticizing law enforcement.
Nope.
Exactly. Now, I don't know, like, the politics or the police department in Durham to know if it's, you know, like, some, they're just known for corruption. New Orleans, Chicago, they're just known for corruption. LAPD had a bad history of corruption for a long time. They finally cleaned it up. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on in Durham. But I do know that if they are professionals, they would have investigated this without bias. But if they weren't, I could see how his criticism of them could play a role.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. If anyone knows how things are there, let us know. But He did try running for city office, city council and the mayor's office, and he didn't win. But it was during the run in 1999 for the mayor's office that it came out that he lied about his military record.
Oh, where? Like what?
Well, and actually not that, but also the honors he received, a Purple Heart. That's only given to those wounded in combat, not wounded. You know, so like like if you're in Vietnam and you shoot your own foot, you're not going to get a Purple Heart.
No,
you're going to, you know, get a bunch of crap from all your fellow soldiers.
Right.
If you get in a wreck, you don't get a Purple Heart. So you only can get those when you're fighting. And he actually was not a wimp. I mean, he saved his men. So why he lied about it, I don't know. He was hurt in a car wreck, and so that ended his political aspirations immediately.
And it'll probably hurt him later down the road.
Probably.
Lying like that, especially military.
And, you know, I was searching in every corner to try to find out, was any of this impacting their marriage? So you have, she's an exec, you got the tech bubble that's burst. She's working long hours. They have a very lively social life. Then you got him, you know, and he lied about his military record and running for office. I mean, that is, I have a friend that's running for office now. And if it wasn't for my association with, you know, the local chamber and stuff, I would have let several people have it and told them how stupid I thought they were. But I have to use self-control.
Right.
But it's vicious, and we're a small town. I can't imagine, you know, the stuff that she would hear, and especially when it came out that he lied. But I couldn't find a single negative thing about their relationship. Not a single person
really
said anything negative about their marriage.
There's always something.
I didn't find anything. I mean, there it might be out there, but from all I could tell, they genuinely loved each other. Now, he was a pervert. I'm just going to say it straight
right,
up.
For sure.
But yeah, I can't. I mean, they were loving. No one said anything bad. That was interesting to me. Now, they were also extremely intentional on how they parented. And what I mean is they used communication as a tool, and they created like a really warm atmosphere for the kids to grow up in. So Margaret and Martha called Kathleen mom. And that can be tough. Like, you've got their mom that's passed away, right? And their dad. They're adopted by Michael. He goes through a divorce. They lose that mother figure. And then Kathleen comes into the picture 10 years, you know, waiting for them to get married. But they called her mom and they loved her to pieces.
I wonder how old they were when she came in the picture.
Let's see, because they would have been little girls, so they were probably adolescent, I'm thinking, whenever they started dating.
So yeah, at that,
that one looks younger, for sure.
Yeah, the one in the white?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I could see it'd be a natural next step to call her mom if you're very young, right?
Well, they didn't. Well, maybe. I don't know. And they did live together before they married, you know, it was a 10-year process. So if they were, I could see if they were younger, like in adolescence when they met, which they would have probably been, because when he moved here, he immediately started dating her.
And especially as warm as she is and welcoming and loving.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that for sure. Okay. Let's see. So obviously Clayton, you know, with the whole, you know, wanting to blow up the building thing, had his problems. Kathleen had started complaining a little bit about the job stress. She was feeling it. And they also had credit card debt on top of college bills. And, you know, the colleges they were going to, they weren't cheap.
Right.
And they also had where, you know, especially the sons, they just didn't seem good with money as far as the kids. Like, it seemed like one of those things where the kids would rack up bills, or they would, you know, want to go do something, and then, you know, the parents are trying to get the money to them and trying to find ways. And so, from what I understand, Kathleen and Michael were tapped out, And so he had been talking to their mother, Patricia, on like, okay, what can you do to help out? I believe it was Clayton, if I'm not mistaken, but it might have been the other son. So there was definitely a lot of debt. And so people point to that as a motive. And I think it was Patricia, if I'm not mistaken, she had actually mortgaged her home once to pay for some of the kids' stuff.
Was that the younger boy? Some reason it keeps popping to my head. Was there a bout with drugs with him, the one that blew up?
I don't know why I keep thinking that. Because I know, like in the staircase, he did seem either he was on prescriptions,
something,
or he was drinking. Like there was something. Like he was definitely struggling. But I don't know if they ever. Like came out that he was on drugs or drinking. Do you remember from the documentary if they say anything?
It was years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember, but it just seems it keeps popping in my head that it was something.
What's also interesting is every kid except for Caitlin, her daughter, stood by him the entire time. They did not waver.
Oh, except her daughter?
Yeah, they did not waver. Okay, now I'm going to use air quotes for the word murder, because I'm not convinced the evidence supports murder, but we're gonna dive into it. But we need the timeline. This is gonna be very important. Would you like some paper so you can take notes?
Nope, I'm good. Thank you.
Uh huh. Yes.
Oh,
pen.
I don't know. I don't have a pen, and I'm trying to do a podcast.
Well, so. You offered the paper.
I was kidding. Yeah, I didn't expect
paper
you to
and pen.
You know, to take me up on. I'll need that back when you're done. Okay. Because it's notes for another episode. Okay. The timeline starts Saturday, December 8th. So mm-hmm. This is 2001.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are you going to do that?
I'm sorry.
The entire time?
December 8th, Saturday, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
At 4:41 p.m., Michael goes to the YMCA for a workout. Okay. Then at 6 p.m., he speaks with Kathleen about renting a movie called America's Sweetheart. So
love that movie.
I'm assuming he's calling her. Maybe, I mean, I'm pretty sure they had cell phones back
yes,
in 2001.
Yes, they did.
Did they?
Yes.
Yep. When did cell phones come out? I don't remember.
Well, I thought it was early 90s. I had the box.
Well, yeah, the big one.
Yeah, I had the big one.
Only
for
rich
a business
people had
phone.
Those.
No, my company gave it to me, and it had a case, and you open it like, Get Smart. Remember that show?
Actually, there were some that were actually in vehicles way before the 80s, if I'm not mistaken. Of course,
really?
They had a lot of money.
That was really rich people.
At 6:59, Michael rents a movie at a local Blockbuster. Between the time he arrives home and 9:45, so he's getting the movie at 6:59. They're thinking it's a little bit after 7 or so. Kathleen and Michael eat dinner. They might have watched the movie in that time frame, because by 9:45 they were seen outside sharing a bottle of wine by the pool by Christine Tomasetti. So she's a friend of Todd Peterson that was taking him to a party. So we've got the 4:41, he goes to train. At 6, he probably calls Kathleen about a movie. At 6:59, he rents a movie at the local Blockbuster, and then we know by 9:45 they're out by the pool.
It's 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. It's a
two hours between training and movie.
That's interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually not 2 hours, because he got the movie at 6:59. I want to know what he's doing between 6 and 6:59.
Well, yeah, it's 2 hours. 4:40 is when he trains.
Oh, well, yeah.
6:59. But yeah, that's an hour.
Yeah. Maybe lots of traffic. Maybe Durham is a little bit more difficult to get through than we think, but it seems like there's just quite a bit of time that goes
and then on. He rented a movie and got home at 9:45.
No, they were seen at the seen by the pool sharing wine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so at the pool at 9:45 is when they have their bottle of wine, which is important. Mm-hmm. So between when he got home, probably around 7 something, and 9:45, they had dinner and they watched the movie. Mm-hmm. Okay, at 10:20, both Kristen and Todd leave for the party. Now, what happens next is where a lot of people disagree. Mm-hmm. A little after Christine and Todd leave, Kathleen tells Michael that she was heading in to check her work email and get some sleep before an early morning meeting at work, and she was not happy about it because it was a Sunday. But she was going to have to go in. So at 10:20, not 11:20, 10:20.
Right, but she only got 4 or 5 hours a night.
So she goes into the house, and then at 10:40, so we've got 10:20, they leave. Between 10:20 and 10:40, the password Atwater is used to log into Peterson's computer, Michael Peterson's, not Kathleen. So I don't know if they had just one computer that they shared, because that was back in the day where most just had one.
Right. You didn't
walk around with tons of laptops and iPads and all that. At 11:08, co-worker Helen Prislinger speaks with Kathleen by phone and agrees to email a file. At 11:53, the email arrives with only the attachment and no message from Helen, and the email is never opened.
Hmm.
So between 11:08, so this is our deal, right? The initial. Because between 11:08 and 11:53, where did Kathleen go? Why did she not respond to the email? Was she showering? Did she do some other things and she didn't make it back before she died? Like, what is going on there? So some say that Kathleen went back out and rejoined Michael. I don't think so. And we only have his version, so that makes it a little bit, we only have the version of the one that was accused. But he said that when Kathleen went inside, he continued sitting by the pool smoking a cigar. I didn't know, when you start a cigar, you must finish it because you cannot relight it. And I learned this by the prosecutor's podcast. I just want to give a plug. They do deep dives. Like, they're the first ones I'm like, oh my gosh, I am totally, like, I'm gonna dig around in this. So they're very, very good. I highly recommend it. And then it takes about 20 to 30 minutes to smoke a cigar. But for some, it can take an hour or more.
Yep.
Okay. Now, other people have said that what Michael was wearing proved he was lying. He was wearing shorts and a shirt in 50-degree weather.
Had some wine, though.
That's so still cold. And so people are like, that's weird because he's cold. He must have gotten rid of the bloody clothing or blah, blah. But he did it all the time. And not only that, Kathleen was wearing flip-flops.
And besides that, if he would have changed... I mean, he wore them all the time. If he would have changed, he'd have put something warmer on.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So I don't think the clothes really matter. Mm-mm. Not only that, 50 degrees in one part of the country can be totally different. Like 50 degrees in Clovis, you're like, fine. If there's no wind,
right.
You can go out for a nice walk if the sun's out. But once that wind starts, you cannot. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's cold.
Yeah.
Well, in Michigan, where my uncle lives, 50 degrees there with humidity feels hotter, no, cooler, but you actually are hotter because of the humidity.
That makes sense.
That happened to Kent. He actually got sick. He was running around playing. I said, you got to be careful here, son, because I know it feels cool, but the humidity was like 70 to 80%. And I said, you're going to overheat. And he did. He started vomiting in their front yard. So if it's humid there, I'm thinking it's going to feel a little bit warmer to them.
And the clothes had nothing to do with it, I don't think.
I don't either. All right. Then, before we continue the timeline, mm-hmm. I want to tell you that they were celebrating that night. because one of Peterson's books had been picked up by Hollywood.
Oh.
So he was receiving an $800,000 check for it.
Do you know which book?
I do not know. And I think it was said, but I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Mysteries, I'm sure.
Well, he had... No, his were war books.
Oh, war books.
Vietnam War books. And so there, you know, he was expecting this check. Some say that they drank two bottles of wine. Some say that they drank one. We know, though, from the autopsy report that Kathleen's alcohol level was 0.07. So if she was driving, she would have been considered drunk. Mm-hmm. And then her urine level was 11.1. And then she'd also taken a Valium. So based on her weight, she had 2 to 3 5-ounce glasses of wine. Now, I know it really depends. Like some wine, I can just have like, you know, 3 to 4 ounces. And I always, you know, tell people when my eyes feel weird, I'm done.
Yeah.
And so after like 3 to 4 ounces of some wine, sure enough, I'm like, nope, I don't, you know, my eyes feel weird. I'm not going to have any more. Others, I can have 2 glasses.
Yeah.
And I don't feel anything at all, or I might start feeling a little bit weird. And so that's when I quit.
She may not have, because she was going up to work.
And, she's going to do the email.
Yeah.
That's right.
So she couldn't have been too impaired.
And I think they loved wine. Like, I don't think they were novices. I think they drank.
I remember that in the documentary.
Yeah. So they probably, you do build a tolerance.
Yeah,
you do. And so they might have had a really good tolerance. But just so people know, she did have 2 to 3 glasses, and she did take a Valium. So either way, I'm thinking it's going to cause a little bit of a loopy.
For sure.
And did she take the Valium so she could get to sleep earlier? Because if she only slept like 4 to 5 hours and she's going to bed early, or, I mean, it's really not that early though. I mean, it's 11:08 when she talks to her coworker by the phone. By the time she showers, by the time she gets ready for bed, it's going to be, you know, close to midnight. If she gets up super early, she still would have gotten very little sleep. But anyway, all that to say, she definitely had some wine and Valium. Okay, now back to our timeline. So we have 11:59. Then at 2:30-ish, we don't know the exact time, Michael heads inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he finds his wife still breathing at the bottom of the staircase. He immediately calls 911 at about 2:41. We do know he was messing with her body, meaning he was trying to get her to, you know, come back to consciousness. He was checking her. I don't think he started performing CPR. So between 2:30-ish, I mean, let's say that he comes in around 2:30 or 2:33 or 2:34. We've got about 7 minutes before he calls 911. But they've found out that from... Well, let's see. No, because he would have to walk from the pool to inside the house. He sees his wife. He starts trying to, you know, what's going on here? Then he calls 911. So if we take in the fact, because it's a huge house, it's a huge yard, the walk and him calling, he called immediately.
Yeah.
Like he wasn't messing with her in any way. He comes in, he sees her, he's probably freaking out. Then he calls 911. I would love to know how long it took him to get there, but they did sound tests to see if they could hear her screaming. Yep. You could not hear anything by the pool. It didn't matter what they did, even in the front yard. If she went into the front yard and screamed, you would not have heard it. That's how big this house is.
But as hurt as she was, who knows if she was even capable of screaming?
Maybe not.
Right.
But I'm thinking if you're being murdered, you might be screaming. But I say that to say that if some people have said there's no way he would have not hurt her.
Right.
No, he wouldn't have hurt her. They tested it. So if he was in the backyard by the pool, he wouldn't have. Okay. Now, I've got this diagram here. Let me see if it'll come up.
Hold on. When you said that he was messing with her, when they arrived, did he have blood on him?
He had blood all over him.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah, but the blood evidence is what seals it for me and why I think I know who killed her. Did y'all get that? Who killed her? Anyway.
Who?
Okay. So I've heard his, and I forgot to bring it up, but you guys can find it. I heard the 911 call. It is one of the most genuine I've heard. So if you go to Murdo, I have no idea what his name is. Mm. If you go to him,
Murdoch.
It is ridiculous. I'm like, okay, first of all, you're not very
good.
That
was sort of obvious.
But he immediately, this is one of the things they look for, he immediately gave the address. If you've killed someone, you don't. That's it, and this may be controversial, but that's why I don't believe Patsy Ramsey killed JonBenet, because she immediately gave the address to get them there.
Even if she wouldn't have, I never thought she was guilty.
I never did either. The whole thing was everybody was freaking out over Patsy. But so he did that. He you can tell he's panicking. He's upset, but it's not over the top, and it's not too little. You can tell the dude is freaking out that he just found his wife. So, again, find it. I think the prosecutors played the 911 call and they analyzed it. At 2:48, so he calls them at 2:41. At 2:48, the paramedics arrive. They find Peterson sobbing and then cradling his wife. Okay? So he's got her in his arms. Todd returns home at this point. Can you imagine? So he pulls up. There's cop cars everywhere, ambulances, flashing lights. He goes in and he sees his stepmom in the condition that she was in, and it was disturbing. Then at 3, so we got 12 minutes later, police and detectives arrive because obviously something's up. So you have paramedics first, then you have them. And at 3:24, they secure the scene, and they're thinking this is foul play.
3 what?
3:24.
Mm-hmm.
Now, right off the bat.
Oh, yeah. Now, here's where I get a little suspicious of Michael. Between 4:15 and 5 a.m., he logs into his office computer.
Mm-hmm.
What is he doing?
Mm-hmm.
Erasing photos. Messages.
He didn't erase photos. No, you're right. No, he did not erase photos. He erased financial records. He didn't erase the photos. They found all of them.
Well, so he's smart enough to know that they always look at the spouse first. He doesn't want them to think that that was a motive, don't you think?
I would think that the gay porn might be a motive.
Yeah.
Just saying. You know, it's just weird.
That's what I would erase right away.
And I'm sorry that I just don't think that I would go to my computer and be on it for 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Unless he was like emailing friends and family on what had happened to get them there. But that is the one thing that bothers me. And they do know that he did erase the financial records, but like the prosecutors brought out, why didn't he erase the gay porn? Like, that would be a motive as well. Like, it doesn't make any sense, because you could say that she discovered that he was gay and they had this huge argument and she threatens a divorce and he lost his temper.
Well, unless, okay, she knew, because the claim was that she knew about that. So mm-hmm. that may be a reason why he didn't think to erase that.
You know, that's a good point, because I'm not sure she did know.
Right.
But if she did, he wouldn't have thought to erase that.
She told a friend that she knew.
I couldn't find that anywhere.
And besides, why would you do financial unless you were hiding something that you were stealing? Maybe. It had to be something.
I feel like he didn't want them to assume that finances were a motive.
Or maybe he was very private with their finances and didn't want people looking through their stuff.
Or yeah. very proud, and he didn't want anyone to know they didn't have money.
Yeah.
Actually, they had $850,000 coming.
Well, yeah,
coming.
But for
she made a good living.
They were debt not, they were in.
That, yeah, but What is interesting about their financial situation is they were not hurting. So even though they had all that debt, they were able to pay all of their bills. And so what they had discussed on that check that was coming is to maybe pay off the house or most of it and a couple other things. So,
well, he did it for a reason. There had to be a reason.
Well, I know. It's just I haven't been able to figure it out. You know, but it could be. It could be he didn't want them to think that, you know, that was a motive, or he was private and he didn't want people to know his financial records. But your wife is dead at the bottom of the staircase and you're on your computer. So it's just a little bit weird.
For that long, too.
Yeah.
And then he phoned his lawyer at 5 a.m. And so his attorney arrived at 5:20. That doesn't bother me at all. I would immediately call my lawyer.
Unless 2 hours before that, they had already suspected foul play. I'm sure it was very apparent.
Yep. Now, from what I understand, Kathleen died shortly after the 911 call. And so Michael actually called back 6 minutes later to say that she had died and to please hurry. So she was alive the first call. And then, you know, they're still not there. He calls them back like, please, she's just died. It took the paramedics 8 minutes to get there.
Oh. Police got there at 3.
Yeah, the paramedics got there at...
Police, paramedics, and detectives.
The paramedics got there at 2:45.
Yeah.
He called at 2:41.
Yeah.
So he's got, you know, 6 minutes he waited, and then she died in that 6 minutes, so he's trying to get them to hurry. So he called them back. Let's dive into the autopsy, and then I figured we were going to have to split this into a two-parter, but I wasn't sure. Okay, this is where it's going to get into the crime scene, Elena, so you probably do not want to look at the computer. Let me pull these up real quick. Okay, so this is a side view, right, of her at the bottom of the staircase. You know, you see her hands there, and then here she is. So you see quite a bit of blood,
right?
Obviously by her head.
And on the wall.
And on the walls. And then she has blood, et cetera, on her hands.
And waist.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, I mean, it's a tremendous amount of blood, but head wounds are like that.
Mm-hmm.
It goes everywhere. And she also has blood on her socks, but there's no blood over there that would account for that much. And so I think that at some points when she was dying, she was walking, like she was standing in her own blood, which I think is important.
Trying to help herself.
Mm-hmm. Then, and this one's not that bad, but this is a staircase where there's a little bit of blood. Obviously, she's not there. And then these are pictures of the staircase. So you can see, I want you to note how low the blood is. Okay? So we're talking
she's falling.
Maybe a foot. Mm-hmm. Right? So when they remove her body, you get a good look at the staircase. The blood goes up maybe a foot, which is going to be important later. And then we can see it's a very narrow staircase there, okay? So I want you to take note before we get too much deeper, but take note of what the wounds look like.
Yeah, like someone hit her.
Mm-mm, not to me.
Really? They look like someone hit her.
And then we do have different woundings and things. It's hard to see everywhere, but the main was the head. Okay. And so what she died of was actually blood loss. She did not die of blunt force trauma.
Two of those wounds looked a lot alike, if you noticed that.
Okay. We're off the crime scene.
Okay.
I was letting you know.
Okay.
Okay. So things are about to get weird. The autopsy report detailed a healthy 48-year-old victim who sustained several deep lacerations on the top and the back. So that's what we were looking at. However, like I said, the medical examiner did not say it was blunt force trauma because blunt force trauma has specific things that happen And she had none of those, which we're going to get into. But she said that Kathleen died from bleeding out. The reason she initially had this cause of death is because blunt force trauma always has skull fractures. Mm-hmm. Always. She had no skull fracture. The other thing is they always have bruising on the brain or brain contusions. So even if it doesn't fracture the skull, there's at least bruising. She did not have that either. So no brain bruising and no skull fragmentation.
A lot of blood.
Right. But it's a head wound. Of course you're going to have a lot of blood. Like when our two dogs, one of the dogs ripped Sam's ear, it looked like my patio looked like a crime scene. There was blood everywhere. It's shocking. I still find blood to this day. My shirt was covered with it because he would shake his head and so much blood was coming out. It just sprayed our entire backyard. And that was from an ear ripping. So she's got these wounds that are massive, as you saw, on her head. She's going to bleed out everywhere, everywhere. So that, the blood doesn't bother me as far as the cause of death. I agree it was sanguination. But what does bother me is later the medical examiner was pressured to change the cause of death from blood loss to blunt force trauma, even though she had no signs of blunt force trauma. There wasn't even bruising. I mean, there's
they're going by the wounds and all the blood, and it led to the death.
The ME also did not think they were caused by her falling downstairs. She said, there's no way that these wounds were caused by that. But that's what the DA wanted her to say, and that's what the cops wanted her to say. So guess what? That's what she said.
Is that documented? That's what they wanted her to say?
Yes.
Both statements?
Yeah. So they made the ME change her conclusions. They pressured her to do it, and so she did. Now, we're going to go back to the autopsy a little bit because there's two things that were, to me, absolute evidence of what I think happened. But for now, the prosecutor's office launched an autopsy into Michael Peterson's life. And what they uncovered was quite shocking. I'm not, again, sure what Michael was doing on his computer when Kathleen was dying that morning, but prosecutors collected electronics and other potential evidence using, you know, a search warrant. Because, I mean, you have to look at the husband right off the bat. They found that he had deleted some financial records. Were those deleted when he was at the computer that morning or later? You know what I mean? Because they didn't arrest him right off the bat. But it does make you wonder if that's what he was doing. If it was the morning that she died, I'd be definitely suspicious, but I don't know. The financial issue seemed normal for an upper class American couple. We've seen a, you know, couple kill or a spouse kill his spouse or her spouse for less, and there was a life insurance policy. But what they found after that is more interesting to me. They found that Michael was bisexual. He had emails, pictures, and websites from and for gay men, including a male escort that later testified on behalf of the prosecution that he and Michael had sex several times. In fact, he was the star of the trial. Very affable, very friendly type of guy, it seemed like. He said that many of his clients were happily married men who were bisexual and needed to scratch that itch. What I find interesting is that Michael didn't delete all of that evidence, you know, of him with these men. And so I don't think he was on the computer to erase those things.
Mm-mm. But or the financial records.
They shared the computer, right? Mm-hmm. I bet 95% she knew. I mean, they shared a computer. Yeah. I mean,
I don't know. She probably had password. Knew.
I could have swore, though, that she had said something to somebody.
Maybe.
But yeah. It's been a while since I saw the show, so.
She might have. And if anybody knows, I would love to know, because her family insists if she knew that he was sleeping with other men, she would have divorced him, because her first husband was unfaithful to her, and that's why she left him and moved in with Michael.
Yeah, but people really don't know what goes on inside people's mm-hmm. homes and their thoughts and their marriages. And
they don't. Now, for the prosecution, these files or subsequent investigation was motive for Michael to kill his wife. The prosecution is seen here. It was a man, female team, which I'll get into the names once I figure out where the heck they are. But they proposed. I forgot about the bird.
Such a beautiful clock. Cuckoo clock.
Yep.
It's the only cuckoo clock I have seen that does two cuckoos for 1 hour.
Yep.
Did you get that from your great, great, great,
whatever.
Great, great,
that whatever. On it?
Whatever. I get a lot of compliments on that
grandmother
thing.
From 80 and 90 year olds
that wore a bonnet and had.
I'm not saying anything. Do you?
Protein.
I get a lot of compliments on that from strangers.
Okay. Anyway, so back to our murderer. Mm-hmm. They proposed on the night of her death that Kathleen discovered the porn emails and the affairs when she went to send her business email, and they fought over it. The prosecutor's podcast said that she divorced her first husband because he had an affair and that she wouldn't have tolerated Michael's infidelities. They believe that she told Michael she was divorcing him, the cops, not the prosecutors. And in a blind rage, he attacked her in the stairwell with a blowpoke, which I was like, what the heck is a blowpoke? So it's a long, thin brass pole that you blow air through to stoke a fire. The problem is they couldn't find the blowpoke. So how did they even come up with that as a murder weapon?
There's some police.
Well, it could have been there part of a set or, I mean, it could be anything.
No,
or
we know exactly
said,
what the blowpoke, why well, I know. They went on to that. Because of Kathleen's sister. So Kathleen's sister, Candace Zamperini, initially believed in Michael's innocence, along with Kathleen's daughter, Caitlin. They all were supportive of him. But after viewing the crime scene photos and the autopsy photos, they're like, nah, he killed her, okay? So she made it her mission to get him. And it dawned on her that she hadn't seen the blowpoke. So there was like a picture with the blowpoke, you know, because it came from a set that she mm-hmm. bought them yeah. as a couple. The blowpoke's gone. So she was like, oh, I bet he killed her with a blowpoke. And maybe that's why there weren't any brain contusions. Maybe that's why there was no bruising, because the blowpoke isn't strong enough. Like, it's real long and thin, and then it might just bend.
Just, yeah.
Yeah. And so she told the DA's office. They searched for it. They couldn't find it. They figured he got rid of it after the murder, which we'll come back to that later. So did you know that she's the one that got the DA onto the blowpoke?
No. Well, I mean, sort of. Since you said it, I knew somebody, but no, I didn't know it was a sister-in-law.
Yeah. Now, what I want to do is I want to stop this episode here because I want to get into the blood splatter, I'm going to say, analyst loosely, because I think this guy... made up crap. But this is where we're at so far. Yeah, they're building their case. They're, you know, going on this argument. And man, I would love to know if Kathleen knew, because I searched high and low trying to find anyone that could say that she knew that he was sleeping with men. Because like you said, no one knows what goes on, you know, behind closed doors. Would she have been okay with it because they were men?
That's what I was thinking whenever you said that she divorced her first husband because he was unfaithful. And I thought, well, this is a different gender.
It is a different gender.
The kids were younger, too. So when you're younger, sometimes you put up with a little less than when you're older.
That's true.
And, I mean, they showed a computer. No, you don't. Good. I'm glad you don't. But
her daughter was young when her first yeah. husband was unfaithful.
Yeah. So as Kathleen got
saying,
older,
I see.
You okay. might.
Maybe she maybe, was. I mean, they had
she
a
loved
good
being
life.
Tolerant, the yeah. kids, her
or
career.
She was part of it.
They were financially. Know. I couldn't find any evidence she was part of it at all.
And she may
and
not
I don't believe she was.
Told anybody because, you know, she's very private, too.
It's,
and
well,
it'd
no,
be
I mean,
embarrassing. Well, yeah, but even if you're a socialite, you're not going to go tell neighbors your husband's, you know,
bisexual,
sleeping with men.
Yeah.
I think she knew.
We'll look it up in a little bit.
Maybe.
So this is, it's an extremely interesting case.
Very.
So let's do a check-in. Where are you at now? Are you still like 100% guilty or do you have some questions?
100% guilty.
Elena?
Now that I remember the case more, not guilty.
Yeah, I think he's not guilty too still. Okay, we'll take a break and then get into two.
Man, I hope my boy...
Outline of a Murder is a Mr. Joseph production. What do you think, Joseph?